The title of the series is The Beginning, End, and Sanctity of Life. It's actually the first time I've, in this shul, but really I think almost anywhere, to the best of my knowledge, even in my previous teaching engagements, that I've entered the foray into medical ethics. And it's one that's always intrigued me. It's the closest thing I'll ever be to becoming a doctor. But it's really very, very important. And what is so fascinating to me about all of these topics that could fit into that category is really, I alluded to this morning in shul, the dynamic interplay between the increasingly the incredible abilities of medical science and the need for people such as ours who are grounded in a thousands-year-old tradition to have to be able to cope with those ever-changing realities. I read somewhere in preparing for this, and this was something that was said about 30 or 40 years ago, that the body of scientific knowledge that the world possesses doubles every 8 years. I don't know if that's still accurate. Maybe, if anything, it's getting quicker. It's an incredible, mind-boggling fact. Think about that. The entire body of knowledge that the whole world has doubles in 8 years. And certainly in the field of medical research, it's astounding. It's almost always levracha, tremendous blessing. Certainly from our perspective, we are by and large predisposed to embracing scientific innovation. And at the same time, as we all know from some of the more celebrated cases, some of the issues, especially at the end of life, are very, very dangerous, and some of them are not a blessing at all. Some of the issues, some of the decisions, things going on in Oregon this past year, I mean, they are completely against our value system. And while we can't cover all of the topics, perhaps we'll do other topics in other series, I did try to pick, and I hope to pick, three topics which are part of that continuum of each one independent, three self-contained lectures, but at the same time, the common thread of our approach to the creation, maintenance, and even when it comes necessary, ending of the sanctity of life. The particular topic I want to discuss this evening is a very, very important one, because I don't know if it's getting more or less common, but it's certainly not uncommon, even in our, especially in our community, for there to be couples who are suffering from infertility. And it's actually one of the fields which has really exploded. The options and the availability for people who have infertility issues in our generation are just, you can't even compare them to what was 10 or 15 years ago, let alone 20, 30, or 40 years ago. It's really unbelievable. And for the couples who really stick it out emotionally, which is not always easy, and some of the things which I'm not getting into, like IVF, are financially expensive. But the truth is, for those who go that whole course, the percentage of people that eventually conceive is actually very high. It doesn't mean for everyone. Those percentages don't help the people who don't conceive. I understand that, of course. But as a community, we can really be thankful for living in such times, because the technology really is incredible, really incredible. Just this past week, I picked up my son from a play date, a young family in the community, not from our shul, and he mentioned to me, I guess maybe he knew that I was speaking about this topic. Anyway, he told me that they were married for 5 years, were actually about to give up. They'd already gone through many things. They're about to give up and go to the adoption route. When, actually, it was Rabbi Weinberger Zatzal who told them to persevere. There were issues of finances for IVF. He lent them the money. And now, Kanai Nahara, they have 4 children. So it's really an amazing world that we live in. But all of these types of procedures really need to be analyzed from a halachic perspective for obvious reasons, and I'll get to shortly some of the questions that really can arise and the major issues I want to discuss. The specific issue and the method that we're talking about here tonight, which is not maybe the first method that a doctor would prescribe, but it's one of the ones, it's certainly less dramatic than something like IVF, is what's known as artificial insemination. And I want to give a little bit of a scientific history of it, and then to discuss the specifics that we'll be mentioning and the questions that we'll be raising. So first, just to give you a very brief thumbnail historical sketch, the legend has it, which we don't have hard historical evidence, the legend has it that it goes back, the first time they were speaking about this being done is actually in the 14th century with horses. Now, the truth is that, especially in the early history of this, and perhaps even to some extent to this very day, come on in, is it was actually much more common with animals because of the money involved. Whereas if you had a stallion for a horse or other type of animals or a great bull, you wanted to turn it into a stud. You wanted to be able to have 500, which is not at all inconceivable. So you obviously there's only so much fathering that the animal can actually do. But if you can extract its sperm, you can do artificial insemination. And there are legends going back to the 14th century. The first scientific evidence that I know of is in the late 18th century in 1780 by an Italian physiologist. And that was with a dog. That was the early scientific evidence that I know of. In terms of humans, so 10 years later in London, we know of a woman who was artificially inseminated in 1790. And the first woman on record in the United States was in 1866. Now, obviously, they were using much cruder methods than we have developed now. But just like making a baby in the most natural sense isn't so complicated, even this in the most crude sense, which again, it's not going to have the high efficiency that we can now achieve, but the basic process doesn't need some of the technological innovations that we have. Just to give you a sample of the legal history, because we're going to be discussing from a Jewish legal perspective the challenges this presents. Just to give you one example, there's a whole part of an article which I have from Rabbi Dr. Michael Broyd, where he has a whole section on the American legal history of this. But just to give you one earlier precedent, so for example, in Canada, the Supreme Court in Ontario in 1922, declared that a woman who had been artificially inseminated by a man other than her husband could be found legally to have committed adultery. I don't think that they still have that, I don't think, in Canada now. But, right. But that was, that reflects the mores of that time, perhaps. But the point is, that is a challenge, that is an issue which we will be discussing from a halakhic perspective, what that status is. And that it was not first thought of by the halakhists. Although perhaps we thought of it before 1922, but it was not only thought of by Jewish rabbis or halachas, it's been something that other legal communities have thought of as well. Let me give you a brief non-Jewish religious history of perspectives. So again, we have the right context. So the first, the most, and I think to this day, still the ruling Roman Catholic pronouncement took place in 1897. In 1897, they absolutely forbade any type of artificial insemination from a man other than the husband of the woman. And they ruled, for those who are familiar with this, this fits in perfectly to their pattern of thought in general, because it goes against, and the words are key, natural law, natural morality, which is the defining precedent for all Catholic decisions, what they determine as natural law. So the idea of being impregnated by someone other than your husband is considered not natural, unnatural, and therefore they forbade that. What about with the husband's sperm? And we'll get to what scenarios would allow, would require, from even from a medical perspective, these different options. But let's say from the husband himself. So there, a little machlokes. We're not the only people who can have machlokes. But the basic inclination that they had was to be strict with anything that was remotely artificial. The one leniency that they had then was there are certain, I don't know how common this is, but there are certain fertility problems where everything genetically is actually fine, but it's, I guess, the motility of the sperm is the problem. So, for example, if a husband and wife were together very naturally, but then the problem was that the sperm were not proceeding up the canal with enough speed, efficiency, etc., so the Catholic Church allowed, after husband and wife having been together, so she could then run to the doctor, and I don't know exactly how they did it, but you could force the sperm up to the canal. That they allowed. Anything more than that, the Catholic Church, and I believe it's more or less the same to this very day, does not allow, even with the husband, and there's nothing that they allow with anyone other than the husband. Protestant Church, the Church of England, they also discuss this later in the mid-20th century, and they made a very neat distinction. They said anything that is from a man other than the husband is prohibited, but on the other hand, they were very lenient when it came to the husband's sperm. So all of this now sets the stage for the question of where do we stand? What is our position on this? And let me just introduce two technical terms. I've alluded to them, but let me just introduce them. Obviously, there are many types of infertility which are not going to be solved by this. For example, if the issue of infertility is on the wife's side. So this is not going to help. This does not even help for all forms of male infertility, depending on the problem. And it's not just a question of more or less severe, although that's obviously true, but even it's more qualitative. The type of problem doesn't always help by this, but certain types of male infertility, this can be very, very successful for. Now, let's assume, for argument's sake, that the husband has one of these types of male infertility, and we want to do artificial insemination with him. So the technical term for that is known as AIH. Very simple. Artificial insemination from the husband. However, there are cases where for whatever reason, whether it was from birth or through some type of injury, where the male is completely infertile and there's simply nothing that can be done for him. So what if his wife still wants to have a baby? And certainly in the general society, you don't need to even have a husband to do this. Let's say a single woman wants to do this. So that is what's known as AID, artificial insemination from a donor. And I want to divide up, just as Lahaziel, we mentioned for the Protestants or even the Roman Catholic Church, they distinguish between the two. Whether our conclusions will be different is a different question, but obviously each one presents different issues. The one of a donor obviously presenting much more potentially controversial or problematic issues. So I want to divide my discussion in those two categories. Since the AID from a donor is much more complicated, we'll spend the bulk of the time of this year discussing that one. And I hope we'll have some time at the end to do some of the issues. They're not as severe, but they are important for AIH for the husband. So let me just mention to you now the six or seven issues which I hope to more or less cover tonight. First case, first question, very profound. I alluded to it already from the Supreme Court of Canada. Is AID, a woman who's married, being impregnated with sperm from someone other than her husband, is that considered adultery? Now, you could perhaps distinguish between whether it was with her husband's permission or knowledge, and without. Or maybe you would make that distinction, and you could go either way. I want to mention, it's just a coincidence, but a more senior rabbinic colleague of mine from New York, who called me on Friday to let me know that he happened to be coming to Baltimore this weekend for a bas mitzvah in another community. So I mentioned to him what I was talking about, and he told me in his community, he's currently involved in trying to help a woman whose husband at this point is refusing to give a get, and they're still in the divorce process. And as it turns out, even though they have three kids, and the whole community knows that they have three children, it turns out nobody knew that it was an artificial insemination from a donor. So now he is at the front of the Besdin screaming that she's an adulteress.
Now?
Yeah. Now the PS, this has to do with the politics of get. My rabbinic friend is encouraging him on the contrary. Don't fight it. Say if he'll give you a get, that's fine. Why does he want to say this? Because he won't have to support the children. So as it so happens, he told me, this guy's such a meshugana, the best thing that could ever happen for the woman is if they say good, because if you say yes, the children are fine. He'll be in your life for another 16 years. So that's the politics and the complications of the get. But I want to just, you think this is a crazy theoretical case. Just yesterday, he told me that he's in a bezdin, and the man is screaming adultery because she was, again, I think impregnated three times, I think he told me, from another man. So that's the question. Is he right? Is that true? Maybe he's right. That's the question. Is that halakhic adultery or not? Number two. Obviously a related question, would the product of such insemination be a mamzer? A very catastrophic question, but one has to be asked. Number three, if we're going to allow it, which is of course the first if, is there a preference whether the donor is Jewish or not Jewish? Very complicated questions. What about now, let's switch for a moment to AIH. So let's assume we're not going to have any of the other problems. It's not adultery if it's the husband. And the children are not going to be, if even the husband. And let's say assume that there's not other problems. Now, even a non-Jew does not make a mamzer. A mamzer has to come from a Jew. But, ironically enough. Here's another question. This can happen, certain types of infertility. There is something called halachic infertility. Which is, halachic infertility could mean that both husband and wife are 100% fertile. But the way of the woman's cycle is such that when she's ovulating, she's always in nida. Her cycle is too short. This is not at all an uncommon problem, unfortunately. There are many other solutions before you run to artificial insemination, potential solutions. But let's say you've exhausted those all. So even though in theory they should be able to conceive, halakhically they can't. So let's say this is the course of action that now the doctors are recommending. The problem is, can you artificially inseminate a woman when she's in nida? Is that a violation of nida? That question cuts on two levels. Number one, did the parents, what husband or wife, did they do anything wrong? And is there a stigma to the child? Now, the truth is that if a child is produced out of a relationship which is not careful in either, which is another way of saying, unfortunately, the overwhelming majority of Jewish children today, because obviously people are not keeping tarot of mishpacha. So the truth is they're not, it's a discussion, but we assume that such a product is not a mamzer. But there is, in halakhic terms, there is some type of a pagam. There is some. Now, will that prevent the person from doing anything? According to the overwhelming majority of poskim, probably not. But I recently was reading a sefer that discusses halachos for bali tshuva, and there was a sefer. There were some poskim who recommended not marrying a bali tshuva for that reason, because there's some taint. So leave aside whether that's good. But we obviously prefer not to have to get into that. The question is there something wrong with doing this when the wife is in nida? Two more questions. Let's assume, again, it's with the husband. Whatever the fertility problem was, but this artificial insemination will solve it. Did the husband fulfill the mitzvah of Pru Revu through this type of artificial conception? And finally, a very serious question is, again, the Puruvu one is, would be a nice, you know, cherry on top, and certainly from a halachic perspective, it's an important thing. But even more severe halachically and potentially as an impediment is, how do we procure the sperm? That is not at all a simple question when we live in, you know, in a tradition which prohibits otherwise man wasting his seed, the prohibition of Sheikh Bazera. So is this, how are you going to get it? Right? Then natural intimacy is...
The question then is, if this is for the purpose, is that still considered...
That's exactly the question. That's exactly the question. Exactly. Exactly. That is the question. Yes?
Is there also a halakhic implication whether or not the donor is a Kohen?
Potentially, right? Good, good. Potential good. Very good.
Maybe the
if you assume, right. So thank you, Goldashira. The way of, so when I said, does the father fulfill the mitzvah of Puruvu, for the sake of our lecture, because we could give many lectures, for instance, we're only going to spend an hour or so on this, and we could spend many hours on all this, but in theory you could distinguish, but well said, for our purposes, we are not going to distinguish between the mitzvah of Puruvu and whether this child is, as the term in halakha, is he b'no l'chol davar? Do we assume that he is the child of said father? In theory, there are some poskim who split those two questions, but we will assume that that's one and the same. If he is his son, he fulfilled Puruvu, and if he is not his son, he did not fulfill Puruvu. And that was one of my questions, and exactly, obviously something like a Kohen would be relevant. So you'll ask me, where does one possibly begin to answer all of these very late 20th century type questions in tradition which didn't start in the 20th century? And the answer is, this is where halakhic creativity comes. And there are basically two or three primary sources around which all of this, and there is voluminous amounts of material. For those who are further interested, I did put a short, selected, secondary source bibliography. There's more I could have put on that, and I'm not even talking obviously about primary sources, just if you're interested in reading more on your own. But there are basically two or three primary sources which everything else hinges on. So that's, of course, where we should start. The first is the Gemara. The Gemara is in Maseches Chagiga. Take a look, the first source on your sheet. Shalu es ben Zoma. They asked ben Zoma the following question. Basula she'ibra mahu l'kohen gadol. A kohen gadol, one of the halachos of kohen gadol, is he cannot marry a woman who is not a virgin. So let's say you have a woman who swears up and down that she is a virgin, but she's with child, as we say. She's pregnant. But she swears that she's a virgin, that she's never been with anybody. So the Gemara asks, Mi chayshinan l'dishmuel d'amar shmuel yochla ni livol kama b'ilos b'lo dam. Please, let's not get sidetracked, although I could understand why your curiosity would be piqued. But we're not going to get sidetracked. Shmuel had a tradition, which he apparently was not embarrassed by, that he knew how to be intimate with a woman without breaking the hymen, without making her lose the physical signs of her virginity. So Shmuel had this special ability. So do we assume that she's lying because she really was with a man, but he had this technique as well, and therefore, even though if we did an internal examination, we sent her to a doctor, he'd say, no, she just don't look like she's a virgin, but obviously she can't be because she's pregnant. Do we worry about that, because what are the likelihood of that? Or not? You can't just rely on that, and you have to assume that if she's with the baby, that means that she obviously was with somebody in a way that really did take away her virginity. Amar Luhu, so the Gemara responds, Dishmuel lo shriach. He had that skill. We can't worry about that. Well, we can't. That's too far-fetched. However, much apparently less far-fetched, Chayshinan shama ba'ambati ibra. Ambati is a bath. Perhaps she was in a bath, and someone had ejaculated into the bath, and that was there before her. And then when she came, somehow it traveled through the water, somehow made it in her. Voila, she's pregnant, even though, of course, she's never been with a man. So she's telling the truth, but she's still pregnant. And that is what the Gemara says. That is the conclusion of the Gemara. It's not likely that it happened. Chayshinan, we're concerned that it happened. And therefore, in this case, paradoxically, she's still a virgin. She just happens to be pregnant anyway. Now, the simple, not that this Gemara is simple, but the simple implications of this Gemara.
The Gemara, she can marry Kohen Gadol.
We're not paskening Hilchot Kohen Gadol, Shiloh. But yeah, the assumption is that you can still be, we can consider the possibility that you are still a basula. Correct. Wow, yeah. Like I said, but many layers of this Gemara. We're just going to tease out the one that's relevant for us. And that is twofold. Number one, if you'll ask, did the Gemara know, or could the Gemara have conceived of the possibility, no pun intended, of pregnancy without physical intimacy? The answer is yes. The Gemara, apparently, the simple understanding of this Gemara, which the overwhelming majority of Rishonim and Achronim accept, is that there is such a reality that is possible, and the Gemara was aware of it. There are some, there's a Mishnah Lamelech, for example, who deny, he rereads the Gemara, he denies it, he says it's impossible, there's no such thing, you can't get pregnant that way, but that he's a minority. Most Rishonim and Poskim assumed that this could exist, and that apparently the Gemara was aware of that. Number two, it sounds like that is considered something that's not inappropriate. Right? The basic questions we started with was, a woman would do such a thing, is she doing something that's terribly inappropriate? Would she even be an adulteress? So apparently, if we want to compare, we'll have to see if this is a good comparison or not, but this Gemara seems to say that assuming the fact that a woman's pregnant doesn't mean that she did anything wrong. Usually, you know, colloquially, you know, forgive me, in popular culture, you know, we say, listen, if you're pregnant, you can't pretend you didn't misbehave, right? But in this case, apparently, halakhically, we acknowledge the possibility that you can become pregnant, and in her case, it's an instance of misbehavior or not, and not misbehave. There's nothing necessarily wrong with it. That seems to be the simple principle that we could extract. Now, is that applicable to AID or not? That's a good question. But that's principle number one. Yes?
I don't want to get off the topic, but does the Gemara at any point, like, I'm not sure, but as far as timing and date, a woman named Mary, like, does that get addressed?
Okay, yeah. It may be lurking. Yeah, okay. Yeah, listen. Okay. Second primary text. A little bit later, but certainly many years ago, in the 13th century, one of the Baalei HaTosfos is Rabbeinu Peretz. Rabbeinu Peretz, the minor Baalei HaTosfos, he also wrote a sefer which is not particularly extant anymore, which wrote a commentary on another sefer of one of the other Baalei HaTosfos, Rav Yitzchak Mikubril, who wrote the Smak, Sefer Mitzvos Katan. So we don't really have this so much, but earlier Achronim or late Rishonim had this, and they quoted. So we know about this because it's often quoted. And the particular text here that's about to be read, I don't believe, to the best of my knowledge, it's not excellent. I don't think we have this as a primary text. But it's quoted by one of our prominent halachists, the Bach, the Bayis Chadash, who wrote a commentary to the Tur. And the Bach, very, very important halachist, he also had a family pedigree. His son-in-law was David Halevi, who wrote the Taz, important halachas from the next generation on the Shulchan Aruch. So they are a very prominent family, and the Bach quotes this. Everyone quotes this from the Bach, and that's really where I want you to look at it from. But Sasi says, I found V'agos smak yoshen me'ra peretz. What does the Rebbeinu Peretz say? The following halachic shayla. Let me ask you a question. A woman who's Anita, now wonderful, nice Jewish lady, she's married, she's Anita. Is she allowed to lie or sit on her husband's sheets, on her husband's bed? And whatever the scenario is, you can imagine, is she allowed to lie on a bed from any other man? Now, we're not talking about with the men or man, because that's a different issue. I mean, are you allowed to even be on the bed? What would potentially be the fear? So, who knows? It could be that, well, if you're on the bed, then perhaps that already suggests intimacy, you could get someone in the mood, lower their guard. That's a fear. The other possibility may relate to our topic. So let's see what the Rabbeinu Peretz says. That's the context he's discussing. Isha Nida, so he paskins, Yechola l'shachev asadine bala. She can sit on the sheets, not, again, if he's in the bed, but she can be on the bed, the sheets of her husband. V'nizharos me sadinim sheshachav aleim ish acher. But she should not sit on the bed or sheets if another man has lied in that bed. Why? Pentis aber me shechpa zera shel acher. Perhaps there was an omission on the bed, and perhaps she'll sit dafka there, won't realize it. And again, similar to the bathhouse from the Gemara, they will swim, and they will perhaps impregnate her. It's possible. So now the question is, if that's the psak, what's the obvious question with that psak? She's Anita, remember. Why do we allow her to sit on the bed of her husband? We don't want a woman to be conceiving when she's Anita. Again, even assuming that it's possible in terms of her cycle and her ovulation. But that's not a good thing. I have sheets here, Tommy. A few more. Because you're a doctor. Okay. So that's the obvious question. If you're worried about something that like that, so then why dry the line there? So it says the second line, middle. Amai ain't no pashashas paintis abra binidusa v'shich v'jerusha baila v'yavlad ben nida. The child will have the stigma of being a ben nida, the child of a woman who was a nida when she conceived. So here's the critical point: is the question, the answer. V'heishiv, he answers. Kevin de ain kan bias iser. Since there was no actual prohibited intimacy, had vlad kosher legamre. So that's why there's nothing wrong with her sitting on her husband's bed. So now we flip the question. So what's the problem if she sits on the bed where some other man had been? Even if she would become impregnated from the semen of another man, there still wouldn't be a stigma. There'd be nothing wrong with the child. Ki halo ben sira kasher haya. We'll leave that aside for a second. We'll get to who ben sira was and what the relevance is in a moment. But the point is, he's affirming that whether it be from the husband or some other man, let's just, for argument's sake, say now the husband is Jewish, let's say, actually not for argument's sake, we'll specifically say, it's another man, but a relative was sleeping over and lay down on that bed. Can she now go on that bed? The husband's brother took a nap, now the husband got up, now she's going to be on that bed. So
prohibited relationship of incest.
Okay, good.
Prohibited relationship.
So, okay, we'll take a third person, just another person, the guy down the block, the neighbor's brother. Okay? I'm not trying to make this into a soap opera, I promise. Chas v'shalom. So what's the problem? Again, so the verbatim parrot says the baby's legitimate. But, Ella, the mishich v'zer shalish acher, we still don't want that happening from another man. Why? Kapitina na havchana, zer shem yisa basachosa mi'ovid k'nisa bi'avamos. We have the following fear. Let's say she'll conceive. You think? And let's say within a day or two then she's intimate with her husband. Does it ever dawn on anybody that it was somebody else? And let's say this person is from the neighborhood. And let's say they'll grow up and, they're not allowed to meet anymore, but let's say you can't really date anymore and you can't have a long engagement anymore, but somehow they got married. A brother and a sister. There could be real incest. They could fall in love with someone. And if you'll think that this is far-fetched, you're right, but it is not crazily far-fetched. In the secular literature that discusses artificial insemination, and of course, especially in today's day and age where all the donors are completely blind, double blind, triple blind, there are cases of problems. And it's not that far-fetched to imagine. It's far-fetched in the sense of there being so many people in the world, but it's certainly not far-fetched for there to be mistakes. And lots of problems could happen, and Chazal are so concerned. Again, you're right, if you wanted to handicap it, it's still in the one and the who knows what's. But when it comes to issues of yichus and issues of potential incest, we are machmir even on the one in a million. If you'll call it a one in a million, I wouldn't argue with you. Let's say it is. Maybe it's less, maybe it's more, I don't know. We'll call it one in a million. We're still machmir. So it's a side tangential problem, it's an important one, but that's the only reason, says Rabbeinu Peretz, that you can't sleep on the bed if another man had been there. But if it was just the husband, even if she's an Ida, the likelihood she's not going to conceive. But even if she does conceive, no problem. So now, what again, the simple understanding of this source seems to also point in the direction that there is nothing wrong with conception, even in otherwise prohibited times, if it's absent of physical relationship. Now, we mentioned this Ben Sira. Who knows who Ben Sira was?
The Apocrypha.
The Apocrypha were these works that were written from the time of the Tanakh, more or less, and Sifrim Chisonim, the Gemara calls, and basically, the assumption is with only one exception, being Ben Sira, we assume that they're somehow not legitimate. We don't give them real traditional validity. However, there seems to be one exception, and that is Ben Sira. Who was Ben Sira? Ben Sira, fascinating story. Ben Sira, I think this much is accepted, he was the son of the daughter of Yirmiyah, which would make Yirmiyah Hanavi his grandfather. The problem was, this girl had the same story has the same claim as the story in the Gemara.
She never got pregnant.
She wasn't married. So what happened? Apparently, look, if you look in the third source on your sheet, this is from a collection called the Otzer Midrashim. Alpha Beta the Ben Sira, this is basically the story. For the sake of time, and because it's hard to read, I'll paraphrase it, but you can feel free to read it yourself if you can focus on the small letters. I apologize, it was faxed to me. This is not exactly available in every shul library, the Ben Sira. But I did get it from an academic library, so the quality is not so great. The story is as follows, without getting into details, there were these Rishayim who were bothering Yirmiyah HaNavi. Again, Yirmiyah HaNavi, not just some rabbi. Yirmiyah HaNavi. And they tempted him and they tortured him, and bottom line was he was in a bath, and he had an emission in the bath, in the water. And Yirmiyahu HaNavi's daughter then went into that bath afterwards, and she conceived from her own father. So Yirmiyahu HaNavi is not only the grandfather to the child, he's also presumably the father of the child. Now, obviously, in any other circumstance, this would be completely illegitimate, halakhically, I mean, beyond anything. And yet, the tradition is that Ben Sira was considered 100% acceptable to Chazal, to the sages, to Chachamim at the time. Ben Sira is considered a legitimate sire. Why? Because it's the same thing as the Gemara in Maseches Chagiga. There was no actual relationship. It was this quirk of a circumstance. Now, I'm not here to discuss it. It's not remotely my expertise. The historical authenticity of the story, this, that, and the other. I'm not an academic, and even if I was, this would probably not have been my field. But one thing which is important for us, and we just saw it from the Arishon, Rabbeinu Peretz, is Halachis quoted it and affirmed it. Now, whether that means they affirmed the historicity of it or the principle of it is not the point. It's minimally the principle of it. That you see from there a model which the Rabbeinu Peretz is willing to endorse, that you see that if this would otherwise be a child with all sorts of problems, in the end there was no stigma, there were no problems, and we didn't excommunicate this woman. We didn't think she did anything terrible. We certainly didn't excommunicate Yirmiyahu HaNavi. We assumed that it was one of these fluke circumstances. So says the Bach, the Rabbeinu Peretz, you see another historical textual model for this. So those, again, are two or three, if you want to call them three, of the earliest sources that discuss somehow vague analogous situations to our cases and to our questions. So the truth is, for the sake of time, I really want to try as much as I can in a 7-page source booklet. This is a very short version, 7-page sources, to give you a little bit of a sense of where this then, now using these primary sources, let's jump now to our day and age and issues of artificial insemination. Not wild cases in a bathtub or on a bedsheet, but where it's being done now because we want to have children who are having infertility issues. So there are those, again, especially since, again, as much as I was alluding to the technology and the breakthroughs, on the one hand, the most basic ability to do this doesn't need much technology at all, which is why I said some of these things were happening perhaps even hundreds, certainly 100 or 150 years ago. And the truth is that even though they're still refining and making it more and more effective, as a halachic issue, this started in the earlier part of the 20th century, in Europe, in Litva, and even in Hungary in the 1920s or so. And certainly it became a huge issue. Again, I didn't trace exactly, because usually when these things explode, if you trace the historically, you see lots of tshuvas about one topic. It's usually because either something was just invented, or something happened, you know, all of a sudden something happened to the water, or all of a sudden the Christians made a rule about money lending, and therefore we have all sorts of ribbishailas at that period and that time. There's a whole field. This is such a field, again, not my field, but there is such an academic field of tracing the history of halacha and using halacha, especially tshuvos, as a source for historical reality. The single greatest expert, to my knowledge, in the world of this is Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, or Soloveitchik's son, who is a professor at Yeshiva University. Again, it's not a huge field. You don't exactly have a department of this in every college. But certainly in Eretz Yisrael, and the big universities, this is a field, and in some of the major research universities in America it is. And he is considered the Gadol Hador in this field. He's written books on it, and tracing historical realities through the tshuvos. You can glean what the issues were going on by what they were asking, what the Rabbanim were dealing with. So I'm not sure exactly what happened in the 50s and 60s. In other words, was there all of a sudden a new technology that all of a sudden become more popular? I didn't have a chance to look into that. But, as you'll see momentarily, there's a tremendous concentration of tshuvos in America in the late 50s and early 1960s. And that's where most of the literature we're going to study tonight comes from. One of the ones who wrote the most on this topic was Rav Moshe Feinstein. He wrote 4 or 5 tshuvas on this topic, Rav Moshe. And in fact, I think if you would ask the family, they would tell you that this position, which he enumerated 5 or 6 different times in all these tshuvas, was probably the single most controversial tshuva or position he ever took. Not necessarily objectively controversial, although it is, you'll see, it is certainly very liberal, but because the reaction was so violently against him, to the point that there were issues of attempted roughing up and things like this. Yes, I have a cousin who grew up on the Lower East Side, and he once told me that he has memories of goons who were attributed to a certain great other gadol who was very against this, being sent to kind of send a message. The message being, don't talk to him in halacha because you'll get nowhere with him, but see if you can work magic with him another way. I recently heard a rumor of something even more severe happening to him, but I didn't want to share it because I'm hoping that it wasn't true. But the point was, it wasn't a simple few years for Moshe when this was a big issue. But to his credit, as you'll see, he constantly reiterates his position. So what is Rav Moshe's position? So we'll see a little bit of this inside. Most of it we'll have to do outside for the sake of time. I didn't give you the entire 5 or 6 tshuvas. I will give you samplings of all of them, because again, then we'd have a much even longer source book. But I arranged them by order of history, by chronology. So this, to the best of my knowledge, is the first tshuva Rav Moshe ever wrote on the topic. This comes from 1959. Rosh Chodesh Nisan Tavshin Yud Tes, 1959. What is the question? So he actually tells an interesting story that the person who asked, really it comes from the Rebbetzin who asked the question, because the woman in question was too embarrassed to ask the Shaila directly to Rav Moshe, so she went to the Rebbetzin, and the Rebbetzin brought the question to her, right? The woman was too embarrassed to ask the rabbi, so instead asked the Rebbetzin, the Rebbetzin asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, and now we have the following question. So he starts off by mentioning the following. If you look at the third line where he begins, the fourth line where he begins his answer, Din Zera Acher. Can a woman become impregnated by another man? AID, as we called it. Mefurish L'Isser. Taz Shehevi Mishum Rabbeinu Peretz. Right? What did the Rabbeinu Peretz say? She shouldn't sleep on a bed, but there was another man who had slept. But what was the reason? Why should she not have done that? Pentis Aber Mishikhba Zera Shal Acher. We're worried. And what was the Gemara's fear? What is the Rebbeinu Peretz assume his fear? Maybe 1 in a million, the child will end up marrying the sister. Right? A very far-fetched, tangential fear. So look at the underlined part, 5 lines down. Hari Chazina says Rav Moshe. What emerges? What do you see clearly? There's nothing inherently problematic with the child. The child's not a mamzer, the child's not anything. The child's fine. We just don't want women doing this because of the confusion that could arise of perhaps, God forbid, this child ultimately falling in love with his own sister and not knowing it. But since that's the only fear that is mentioned, and it's codified even in subsequent sources, Yesh lahatir b'zerah shel nachor. Moshe says not only is AID permissible, Rav Moshe is an advocate that it's better to have the donor be a non-Jew. Why? Shekevan shehablad yeh Yisrael, kevan shehimo Yisraelis, on the one hand, since the mother's Jewish. A Jewish identity goes based on the mother, so the child will be Jewish. But the halacha is that if you have, again, let's say you just have a mixed marriage, you have a couple that a non-Jewish man and a Jewish woman. So from the halachic perspective, again, couples like this are typically not asking halachic shailas, but to the extent that they would, the child would be 100% Jewish, but there is no halachic relationship between the child and his father. The notion of yichus, halachic strings attached, relating relationships, there is no such thing for non-Jews. Halacha does not recognize that. So this non-Jewish father, on a biological level, was the father of this child, and perhaps that has some halachic realities, perhaps not. But in terms of the halachos of yichus, meaning, even if he'll eventually, let's say this person was one of these people, and there are such people, right, who were significant sperm donors. So let's say eventually this kid falls in love and marries a girl from a different mother, of course, but who had the same sperm donor father, which is the fear of Rabbeinu Peretz. Gemara says Rav Moshe, but that'll be okay. Because halachically, they're not brothers and sisters. Because it goes based on the father. That type of relationship goes based on the father. And in this case, neither of them have fathers, technically. So therefore, they're not siblings. So that even that 1 in a million fear will disappear, says Rav Moshe, if you use non-Jewish donor sperm. That is Rav Moshe's ingenious solution to this problem. One second, let me just finish the thought here. I'm at 4 or 5 lines down in the underline. The non-Jewish father has no yichus. That would be if they were even living together and the baby was conceived naturally. It's as if it was like through the bath here, says Rav Moshe. No problem. Let me just finish this source. The rest of the part I'll paraphrase. Says Rav Moshe the following. Why does this couple want to have this non-Jewish donor? Because the husband was impotent. So Rav Moshe says the following. We have a halacha typically of havchana, right? If you know, leave aside all the other emotional issues. If a woman, let's say, divorced or became a widow, so even if she would want to, she's not allowed to get remarried until she waits at least 3 months. Why? Because let's say she would all of a sudden be showing, if it was this, in such a short period of time, we would not be able to know who the father was. Obviously, this predates genetic testing, but that is a halacha that is a very important one. So the an analog of that would be that typically in such a situation, you would have said, again, this couple's already married, But you would have said, says Rav Moshe, even if you're going to do this, but okay, then the couple cannot live together for at least 3 months. Because if they are together, until now he's impotent, maybe Hashem will make a miracle, and now all of a sudden they'll be able to conceive. One could have made such an argument. So Rav Moshe says it depends on the doctors here. Rav Moshe is willing to trust the doctors. If the doctors say that he has no, you know, whatever the problem is, and, you know, he hasn't been able to conceive, but in theory there's a 1 in 1,000,000 chance he could father a child. So then Rav Moshe says, you're right, then they have, they cannot be together for 3 months, because we need to make sure that she was pregnant so we know who the father was. But, says Rav Moshe, the doctors say there's no way, let's say it would be some terrible injury or whatever, where there's just simply no scientific way this person could ever father a child. So Rav Moshe says, not a problem, you don't even have to wait. The day she comes home from the doctor's office, you don't have to worry about any complications, which is an additional heter upon his heter. Let's turn over the page. He writes here on the second underlined part, again, of course, this is not something that he's recommending lightly, but the case here is if it's a shasa ka gadol, mitztari ma'od, b'tshukasam levlad, the parents are in tremendous pain and there's a great desire to have a child, it is mutter lizrok la'isha b'maya zera shal nachri dafka. Better to use a non-Jew, you can have that that donor there. He discusses some of the other details. What if you don't know who the donor is? Which again is a major issue in America. The blind. So Rav Moshe says basically you can assume. Again, I don't know what he would have said in Israel for obvious reasons that might have been different. But in America, he says you can assume this is another his third heter upon heter upon heter. If you don't know who the donor is, you have a right to assume that the donor wasn't Jewish. And therefore, again, the child will have no problems. Not only as a young person, won't even have to worry about when he or she's ready to get married. No problem. This is Rav Moshe's big kula. Now, the last line, he mentions his big yesod, which is implicit. We've kind of alluded to it until now. But he makes explicit, and he hammers home in every one of his tshuvas. And that is, it's the last underlined part that I have here in this tshuva. Rav Moshe reiterates time and time again in his tshuvas that what do you see from the Gemara and Maseches Chagiga and the Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz? That when it comes to illicit relationships, and when it comes to the issue of sometimes children having a status as product of illicit relationships, the only time that that is violated on either level, the husband and wife themselves, or the let's say the mother, did she do anything wrong? Number two, is the product, is there any stigma to the child? So there are motion you see from those sources that the only time that ever happens, if there was an actual act of physical intimacy, derech bia. But if she just conceives, even though to be actually together with this man would be, of course, prohibited. How many Yisurim could come up with if she actually was with him? But if it wasn't that they were actually physically intimate, it's just that his sperm made its way into her body. So again, on some level, you could call that a very intimate thing. Now, we're not going to make light of that notion for the man or the woman, especially. But the bottom line says, Rav Moshe, there's no prohibition. And since she didn't do anything wrong having it placed inside of her, inserted in her, it's also true, therefore, that there's not going to be a problem. So this leads Rav Moshe to the conclusion that therefore she did not commit adultery in such a case, despite the fact that this man, this whole Jew in Munzi, is claiming that his wife committed adultery by having AID. So again, he'll hold against Rav Moshe. We'll see who we can hold like in a second. But Rav Moshe holds nothing wrong, with the woman didn't do anything wrong. And number two is there's no stigma whatsoever to the child. Again, a non-Jew anyway couldn't produce a mamzer. It could produce potential other problems. But even let's say you had a Jew, so that potentially, again, if a married woman has an adulterous affair, that child from such a product of relationship would be a mamzer. But says Rav Moshe, that does not count here because it's not, again, what we would call an affair. It wasn't. There was no physical relationship. It's only this very, in a certain sense, cold scientific procedure, and therefore there's no problem. This is Rav Moshe's big yisod, and whatever dominoes flow from that, Rav Moshe allows them to go to their logical conclusion.
Rav Moshe assumes in our prior sources that the issue is no physical contact as opposed to the issue being no intent.
That is exactly, well, that's good.
Either
good.
Either
excellent.
Can be the issue.
Excellent. 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 Good, good.
Does he discuss why he comes out that way?
That is the simple reading of those texts, especially of Rabbeinu Peretz, who says explicitly the issue is because there's no bias isser. Okay? So let me just mention for the sake of time, again, obviously we're not going to read the rest of these tshuvas for emotion, but as you can see, the second tshuva here is from 1961. Here is here. Each one of the cases has a nuance. In that case, it was a married woman, 10 years, but she did this without her husband's permission. It wasn't a joint decision. She snuck out and did it. So Rav Moshe thinks that she did a terrible thing. He's very upset at her. He thinks that that's completely inappropriate. But he says she certainly doesn't have to divorce her. It's not a right thing. It's still not considered adulterous. But of course, on the other hand, you have to be a little bit fair to the husband. You can't expect him to have to support those children. Or obviously not his. and didn't agree to have. That's why it happened. But bottom line, Rav Moshe, again, it reiterates there. In the third shuva that I have from you is from 1962. And you see, just in the beginning, I want to show you a little bit. We'll get to the details of it in a second. You see in the third, this is I'm on page 3 now with underlined parts. He writes here, I've received your letter. He writes to this person he's responding to. Mole divrei tochacha. Your letter was filled with criticism of me. Amasha lefi dato nidma lo shetshuvasi, in the earlier ones that we've already read, yirgmuru eza pirtsa vataras vizushas yuchas klal Yisrael. You think that my tshuva allowing this is a terrible breach in the sanctity of the Jewish family, it's a chil Hashem, and Rav Moshe writes that you felt bad about saying all these things, and I'm telling you it's okay, I'm not upset at you, but you're still totally wrong and I'm still totally right. He doesn't flinch. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. If you see the third, fourth line, at the middle of the line, where I have it underlined, he goes, don't worry, you shouldn't be embarrassed from giving me tochacha. I don't mind. Aval ha-emes, sh'ein b'dvarim shekatavti v'sha'arasi, shum davar, sh'igra, sh'chil Hashem. There's nothing I said that's wrong. Everything's fine. Ela taras emes, medivir rabbi seder rishonim. And then he really throws the book, as you can tell, you just see the pressures that Moshe going on to Rav Moshe, because he doesn't usually get belligerent in the other direction. You'll see he has a shtach. To the other guy, it's ironic because they're quote-unquote taking the quote firmer position. He writes there that your positions, I don't know what he's referring to because he's speaking somewhat vaguely, says your positions are not just based on Torah sources. You are mixed with other influences. Whereas my reasoning is totally based on Torah sources, whether it be l'kula or l'chumra, lenient or strict. I'm looking at it from a pure Torah perspective. You have other political or other considerations going involved. I mean, really, you don't see that too much in Rav Moshe that he hits back. He knew how to take a punch. But a counterpunch he didn't usually do, and in this case he actually did both. But again, it reiterates the idea. And the last tshuva that I want you to see from him for now, next page 4, is the most recent one, the last one, I guess. I think it's from 1981. Marchesh ben Tavshin Mem Aleph. And it's sort of Yaakov Ellenson. Some of you may know he was a big Kamachach and Eretz who wrote many svarim about women in halacha. And in fact, for one of his volumes, he sent Rav Moshe some shilas, which are then included also there and in Rav Moshe. Ha'isha b'halacha, many of the schools use that as a primary text, both in Israel and I think in America. A lot of schools use these. He has a very wonderful son, Rabbi Ellenson. So he wrote Moshe Tshuva. And this is the last one that Rav Moshe wrote on the topic. And he has little notes, and he reaffirms, look at Sipkan Heyer, he reaffirms, I haven't changed anything. Ubar ledina lo shayach l'skaret mem. It's not shayach for me to regret anything I wrote, because everything I wrote is 100% correct, he says. But he does add, look at this second line, Lamaisa Lohoresi La Soskane. I've never actually told someone to do this who asked whether it's a good idea or not. I don't think there's anything wrong with it, technically, but I've never said to do it. Shalinian kiyam for Puravu La Viola and Zaklum. The husband certainly doesn't fulfill Puravu if someone else fathers his wife's children. But Isha Hayana Masayevis, and the woman doesn't have any obligation to have children. And furthermore, she Shaya Shiyatsam is a kina gadola la baila. This is not necessarily going to be the best thing for a marriage relationship if a husband and wife have to live together when she's carrying someone else's child. So he thinks this is fraught with many practical problems. He doesn't necessarily advise it, but he still felt he never backs down halakhically from a position that he thinks this is okay. Now, as I alluded to already, and Rav Moshe himself alluded to, he suffered intense criticism in the 1960s for this. If I'm not mistaken, when he originally wrote the Tshuva in 1958, but in the early 60s, intense, intense criticism in Eretz Yisrael and in America. And the most well-known opposition, ironically enough, unfortunately, not ironically, but unfortunately, I don't have his Tshuvas for you because I had to have these facts and they didn't come out clearly enough. You wouldn't be able to read them. But there are Tshuvas, I have them in my office now, was from the Satmar Rebbe. The Divrei Yoel, the Satmar Rebbe, has 5 Tshuvas on the topic, and he goes to town against Rav Moshe. I mean, vicious. It's a very, very passionate debate. And he thinks that Rav Moshe is wrong on everything. Namely, it is considered adultery for a married woman to be impregnated with anyone else but her husband's sperm. And therefore, as a result, Rav Satmar Rebbe is willing to paskin, children born in such a context would be mamzerim. And he is just apocalyptic, just beside himself. That Rav Moshe could have done such a thing. There are some other poskim who are slightly less apocalyptic or extreme, but also beside themselves with Rav Moshe. I put 2 of them down on the sheet for you, although, again, there's important nuances between them. We won't have time to read them all inside. The Chalkas Yaakov is Rabbi Breish, who was a great chief rabbi in Switzerland. You see here in the tshuva here on the bottom of page 4, he's being asked by one of the other great gedolim of Europe at the time, Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, the Sri Yesh. So you know who the Chalkas Yaakov was in the Sri Yesh, asking him shilas. And he is also, I forgot to mention, even though this is very well known in the name of Satmar Rebbe, I realize that it's not entirely surprising that he was so passionate, because there was a Hungarian Rav, Samar was, of course, Hungarian. In 1920, the Archele of Tzulerson, who already in 1920 paskined that such a things were considered adultery in the Charles of Mamzer. So there was a Hungarian tradition, which the Satmar Rebbe maybe embellished upon, but he was not the first Hungarian to take such a position. But anyway, you have, besides this Satmar Hungarian Masorah, you have the Chalkas Yaakov, who also feels that this is a terrible thing, and as well as, interestingly enough, contemporary sage, the Tzitz Eliezer. I say it's interesting, the Tzitz Eliezer, as we'll see, for example, next week on the issue of abortion, is actually known in some medical ethics issues to be incredibly lenient. The shoe we'll see next week is literally on the other foot. The things that Rav Moshe says about the Tzitz Eliezer's leniencies in abortion, he basically calls him a murderer. Because the Tzitz Eliezer is so lenient on questions of abortion. But they literally switch sides, if you will, on the Chumrah Kula scale on this. Because the Tzitz Eliezer also can't believe that Rav Moshe is allowing such a thing. Now, there is a nuance in that the Chalkas Yaakov says explicitly that it's not adultery. He admits conceptually to Rav Moshe that it's right, that he's right, it's not adultery. But just like Rav Moshe backtracked a little bit and said, I never recommended it, the Chalkas Yaakov says, it's a terrible, disgusting, horrible thing. How can you imagine Jewish women being impregnated from non-Jewish men? It's just a horrible, disgusting thing. If you look here, if you look at the top line here, and again, in the middle of page 4, Kamuvan Shemitzad Daseinu, from our religious perspective, Ha'isr Barur Mavur, it's absolutely prohibited. Sholasat Baram Kurim Uhum Kuarim, disgusting and revolting, Ke'elu Hadomim Umais Eretz Kanan V'tov Oseyem, it's like the Canaanites and their abominations. I mean, again, very heavy, emotionally laden rhetoric. On the other hand, he still thinks that technically Rav Moshe was right, unlike the Satmar Rebbe. It's not a mamzer. He would not pass on as a mamzer, but he holds it's absolutely 100% prohibited. The Tzitz Eliezer, if you'll turn over the page, says that he goes all the way. He says that the very act of insemination is ke'ain. It's akin to an act of adultery. And about the question of the children, if you even just flip for a second to the next page briefly, you'll see that the Tzitz Eliezer ends that top page. Shami Suffolk Psul Vavadaluya. So it says a child is a Suffolk mamzer. He's not sure. I don't know. Does that mean if you went to the Tzitz Eliezer and you said, can I marry this person? My guess is he would say no, but I'm not sure. So I don't know if he gained anything over the Satmar Rebbe with his Suffolk. But basically, that's a nuance, but again, they're all in agreement against Rav Moshe. This is a terrible thing, and you shouldn't do it. Very, very briefly, let me just give you two explanations that you might be wondering. Rav Moshe had these great proofs. He had a Gemara in Chagiga, and he had a Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz. So what did they do with that? So they have two ways to disprove that, both from their own sources as well as rationales. The rationale, the first one I'll mention is what Jim mentioned, which is that who says, and this is an argument that Tzitz Eliezer and others make, who said you can use the source in Chagiga with the girl in the bathtub as a proof? And they make two points, basically what Jim said, namely, in the bathtub, there was no action, and there was no intent. Right? She's in a bath, and somehow the water just went that way. Whereas in the case of, you go to the doctor, and you ask him to artificially inseminate you, there's obviously intent, and there is, maybe not perhaps by the donor, a doctor, a middleman, but there is somebody who's actually implanting this sperm. So they see that as two reasons why that cannot be an effective source, because there's two things that make our case worse. What about the case with the Nida sitting on the bed? Didn't the Rabbeinu Peretz make it clear that there's nothing fundamentally wrong with that? So they said, yes, that's Rabbeinu Peretz, but who said he's the only Rishon? If you look at the Shilte Giborim, it's in the middle of page 5. The Shilte Giborim says, technically, it is considered, and we actually view that relationship and the child that's produced from that as the same way as if there was actual physical intercourse. So why do we allow the woman to sit on the sheets of her bed? Because he says something I alluded to before, which is, it's not a good thing to be the product of a Nida violation, to be a Ben Nida. But it's also not the end of the world. It's not going to affect who you marry. So you're a Ben Nida, there's a little stigma. But it's so unlikely, and the stakes are so low, so we say, no, you can sit on the same bed as your husband took a nap on. But it's not. But the fact that he says it in such a way shows that he clearly holds that if there would be an actual child, he would have viewed it with the same stigma as if the child would have been the product of an actual physical relationship. So you have a Rishon that diffuses that, you have a Svara to diffuse the first one, and you also have a Ramban. The Satmar Rebbe made famous a Ramban that many other posts can quote. I have it here from the Tzitz Eliezer on page 5. The Satmar Rebbe quoted a Ramban on the following post. The post that tells us about adultery comes from Vayikra, Tarek Yud Ches Pasachof. It's actually a very difficult to read Pasach. This is why we needed a Ramban. The Pasuk is the El Eshes Amisecha, Lo Sitain Shechavdecha Lezera Letamava. Which is another way of saying, again, colloquially you would say, you shouldn't have an adulterous affair with your friend's wife. That's what the Pasuk is trying to tell you. But the syntax, the way the Pasuk is worded, is Lo Sitain Shechavdecha Lezera Letamava.
Sounds like Noah.
So, specifically, the point is that the Ramban makes is, who needs the word Lazara? Latamaba, it would be a contaminated relationship to have to be with another person's wife. Well, why does it specifically mention Lazara? I mean, the seed, the sperm? So the Ramban says, then, this is here, you see this on page 5, the Sitzel Ezra quotes this Ramban, that the reason is that the Torah was giving a reason. What is the primary reason for the prohibition of adultery? Because of the implantation of the seed. You won't know who the father will be. So that's exactly what we're doing here. We're taking another person's zera and we're putting it into a woman. So says the Sam Rebbe, you see from this Ramban, implantation of four other man's seed equals adultery. Now Rav Moshe and others respond that, first of all, that's not what Ramban said. Plus, the Ramban al Torah is not a halachic source. So half the Sam Rebbe's chuvos are to defend the fact that you can use the Ramban al Torah as a halachic source. It's a labedik, you know, back and forth. But yes. Yes, so the adultery will be worse for the from the Jew, but on the, if you will, repulsion factor.
Right.
So the idea, that's what he speaks about. It's against Ruach Das Yisrael. It's against the spirit. How could a Jewish woman be being impregnated? How could we be, again, that's what they're saying to Moshe. How could you be advocating Jewish women being impregnated by, again, and on some level, you could understand exactly what they're saying. It's pretty radical, which is why you also understand why Moshe attests that he never really practically advised it, even though he thinks that there's technically nothing wrong. Let me just spend a few more minutes, and I want to wrap up the second half, which is obviously not two equal halves, I didn't intend them to be, the issue of AIH, where you have the actual husband, who, even though he must have some fertility in the sperm, but for whatever reason, it's not working to conceive in a natural way. I'll just also mention at the middle of page 6, Idavka quoted something from Rabbi Dr. Jacobovitz. I did it not only because there's some very fascinating quotes here, but also because I wanted to just be Yotzei, and I do now, the Yotzei giving kavod to Rabbi Dr. Sir Emanuel Jacobowitz, who's one of my heroes. He's Dr.
Lord.
Yes, I meant not Sir, I meant Lord. When I see his son, I say, oh, it's the son of the Lord. I just did it on Thursday night at a wedding. It's the Lord's son. You asked me before about Christianity, he's the Lord's son, Dr. Julian Jacobowitz. So Dr. Jacobowitz is one of my heroes, and it's specifically in this field, this book, I have it on the bibliography for you, I bought it at the used Shomrei book sale for $5.99, it was then $5.99 in 1975, I got it for $1 at Shomrei. That book was originally his PhD thesis in 1955, and the verse that I have was an adaptation that came out in the 70s. As he writes in the introduction, he doesn't say this about himself, but essentially what he's basically telling you is, he is literally the father, no pun intended for our topic, the artificial father of the field of Jewish medical ethics. The word didn't exist until he entitled his thesis with that word. So we talked about Christian medical ethics and this medical ethics. There was no literature anywhere in the English language that you could not find a paper or a book anywhere that referred to Jewish medical ethics until his dissertation in 1955. He is literally the founder of an entire field. How have I? You know, if he never became the Lord, that would already been an accomplishment. So it's worth just giving him kavod that we should use Sisposav Zavos Mikever, we should learn his Torah. So I put a little bit of a quote here from the end of his chapter on the topic of artificial insemination. Let's turn very briefly, we'll spend another 10 minutes on the topic of AIH. What if it's the actual husband's sperm? Again, he obviously has some fertility for this to work, but nevertheless, whatever reason, the motility of them, they're not getting where they need to go in order to conceive in the natural way. Therefore, we want to take his sperm and artificially impregnate his wife with that sperm. So what are the issues there? So the most serious issue, of course, is what if it needs to be done from the doctor's perspective when she's in Nida? That's the most serious issue. So what would Rav Moshe say? Rav Moshe says, of course, it's better not to, but if there's nothing wrong with it. Because Rav Moshe holds that there's no relationship there. So just like if it's permissible to have a non-Jew sperm, so it's certainly permissible, says Rav Moshe, to have even at the time of Nida, because we don't look at that as being anything done wrong whatsoever. And again, most, although not all, would agree with that in that case. Although, of course, if you take the perspective that it's essentially equal to a physical relationship, which the Sama Rebbe and others hold, then this would be prohibited as well. Number two, a very important thing, when we're going to have these type of activities, we want there to be halachic accomplishment. So the most obvious halachic accomplishment would be, does the husband fulfill Puruvu this way? Is there a yichus between this child and him? So the one thing will say, of course, it's his genetic material. On the other hand, certainly the child is not being produced in a natural way, the way the Torah more typically would anticipate or predict. So this itself is a little bit of a discussion. Again, well before artificial insemination. What about the case in the bathtub? Right? Again, any type of conception without a physical intimacy. Is that considered?
So Yirmiyahu wasn't considered. There's no yichus.
No, he was considered Yirmiyahu's son. No, he was considered Yirmiyahu son. He wasn't considered a pagam. It wasn't a taint to him. So if you look at the Chalkas Machokik, one of the commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch and Ibn Ezer, he raises the question. Yesh l'stapik. Yishish n'sabra v'ambati im kim ha'av pru revu im mikri b'no l'chol davar. Isn't he the father or not? Did he get his mitzvah points for pru revu? So the next one, the next source, the Beis Shmuel, another commentary, says, I'll give you a proof. Yesh l'havi raya. Yimash ha'kasta b'agos smach. Rabbeinu Peretz says, it's considered his child. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just that we don't want that he should one day have grown up marrying his sister without knowing it. But fundamentally, we view that as being there's nothing wrong with it, and that's the child. Nishma dehavi b'no l'chodavar. If we said that it wasn't the father's son, the father's child, then there'd be no problem marrying his sister, because it wouldn't be his sister. The fact that we would theoretically have that worry, you see, says the Beis Shmuel, that if you're impregnated that way, the father, the genetic donor, is considered the father. If it would be non-Jew, you would have that status. Again, from the perspective of Yichus, and if it would be the Jew, you have that status. And many, many poskim quote and affirm this notion, none other than Rav Moshe, but many others as well. So we'll assume that if the father is the donor, that he will be most likely, according to most poskim, fulfill Peru Revu. So our last question, which is a very sensitive question, is how are we going to procure this sperm? How are we going to get it? So there's a number of other suggestions, and for the sake of brevity, I will just tell you them outside. You can find them mostly in the next two tshuvas that I have here, again, from Rav Moshe Feinstein. The one on the bottom of page 6 was actually written in 1958 to none other than... Did I get that year right? I think so. I'm not sure exactly. But that's written, it's one of the earliest tshuvas here, written to Rav Ephraim Greenblatt in Memphis, famous Rivos Ephraim. Okay, and then there's another tshuva here, again, the last tshuva on the page, which is again written in 1961. There Rav Moshe discusses this, and Rav Moshe basically has the following preferences. The ideal, if this can be done medically, is that the husband and wife should be together like they would any other time. And then, whether it's in the house or she has to go run to the doctor's office, but somehow if they can somehow extract, if that's the right word, they can somehow remove the sperm from the woman's body, so then everything was done naturally, everything was done halakhically, there's no problem. Apparently, this is not an uncommon. This can be done medically, and in fact, in certain fertility clinics, they have rooms for the husband and wife to be together. So this, Rav Moshe is very against from a tznius perspective. He says this is a terrible thing. You're not going to be in that doctor's office. But if it can be done where they have certain more privacy and more tznius, and you can still extract the sperm in a way that would be helpful, so that's without a doubt by far the first choice. I'm not sure which one is 2 and which one is 3, but the next two that Rav Moshe explicitly mentions in these tshuvos. Or either if the husband and wife are together, and right before the last moment, the husband removes himself, and then he says, Ramosha says, gets to a cup, and ejaculates into a cup. So there, at least everything until the last moment was natural. That's one of Ramosha's preferences. And his other preference, Ramosha says explicitly, is to use a condom. Now, of course, you have to be smart. You have to get special kind of condoms, because most condoms are made with spermicide. That's not going to work here. Most people would use condoms in our world. Most people, they don't want to get pregnant. Here, where you want to get pregnant, so you're going to have to get a special kind of condom. But apparently these exist. I have heard that there are some post in Israel, when this is recommended, what they do is they will actually pierce the condom a little bit, so that hopefully some of the sperm will come out. So that makes it an even more natural process, and then hopefully there's still enough remaining in the condom that they can extract from that. But that's, I don't know how mainstream or not that chumrah is, but I don't know if you're not losing anything, I don't know if you gain. But hopefully, if you're not losing in terms of the practicalities of it, then that is also another option. The last one, which is sometimes necessary, if for whatever reason other things don't work, is an issue of masturbation. And this Rav Moshe actually prohibits. All the other ones Rav Moshe is okay with. Although, ironically enough, when it's allowed, in terms of general AIH, so Tzitzit Ezra would allow any way of procurement, even that. But that Rav Moshe reiterates in multiple tshuvas that under no circumstances is that permitted, even if it means not being able to have a child. So he gives you 3 or 4 other options. There's no reason why some of those shouldn't work. But hopefully they would, because the last option, at least Rav Moshe is not willing to open the door for. Although, as I said, there's at least one post-sake who would.
What about the son? If it's the husband, then he said he was so against Rav Moshe if it was just the donor.
Yes. Yeah, I'll say this. It's Eliezer. So he's not a fan of it.
But that's not
really
also.
I don't think so. Yeah, they're not fans of any of this stuff. Well, but you wouldn't call necessarily a mamzer from the father.
It's not adultery.
Right. But they're still not fans of it. They're still not recommending it. But it is true, I believe, that it is much more common. Most poskim, again, you try other things first. But if it comes to this, most poskim that I know of Again, I think the general consensus, whether it's because they agree or disagree with Rav Moshe, the general practice is to be machmir on the case of AID. We're not so into women becoming impregnated by other people's sperm, Jew or non-Jew, for a variety of reasons. Again, that may be technically mutter, and maybe in some cases it is allowed, but if you look in Dr. Jacobowitz's, let's see, he writes that the gist is to be against AID, but the overwhelming gist in the other direction, when it's AIH for the husband, is to allow it. Again, it is fraught with some halakha complications, and that has to be worked on, to be done correctly with a doctor and a rabbi, but most posts, not all, but most poskim, my impression, I have not involved in any of these cases directly yet, but would be permissive in that regard. So thank you very much. I'm happy to stay around if there are some questions. I know the hour is late, and I thank you very much for coming, and I thank you for listening, and I hope to see you next week. I didn't hit stop. I didn't touch it. I hope it's on.